This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Monday. It is the last Monday of the month, in fact, which means Boston Mayor Michelle Wu is on the line for Mondays with the Mayor. Join the conversation. If you live in Boston, what do you want to know from your mayor? Or maybe you work in the city or you visit a lot. She will take your questions as well as ours. Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You also have two other avenues. You can tweet us. We're at Radio Boston. Or you can email at radioboston@gmail.com. Mayor Michelle Wu, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Tiziana. Great to be with you.
Great to have you. Always so much we can talk about, Mayor Wu, but there have been some really big stories this past week that we want to make sure we touch on, beginning with the tragic collapse of part of the Government Center garage early Saturday evening. It killed 51-year-old Peter Mancini of Southeastern. Now, the Office of Occupational Safe and Healthy Safety and Health Administration is investigating. So is the Suffolk County DA's office. Have you received any updates on the investigation or any other new information today that you can share with us?
Oh, this is just, it's devastating. And I can't imagine for his family and all of his coworkers on the job. And this is a situation where no family should have to worry about their loved one coming back from work at that night. I was on scene a couple nights ago and know that crews were, first responders and public safety agencies were there all night, ensuring that the site was still stabilized. And there's still some more work that needs to be done to stabilize the public transit tunnels that run underneath the site as well. So the MBTA will continue to be diverted for some time, but we are going to do whatever possible to get to the bottom of this in terms of the investigation. And in the meantime, there's a lot of work happening to ensure that all the safety checks will be fully satisfied before anything else proceeds. I mean, this is a very large, complex demolition project right in the thick of the city downtown with buildings right nearby. And so what I think in other situations would have been just a large detonation potentially of the whole building is just not feasible. And so this demolition project is very complex.
When you say, they'll do everything you can to get to the bottom of it, what can the city do? What part are you focused on in trying to get to the bottom of this?
Well, we'll get the reports back from OSHA on the sequence of events and what exactly happened. Our interest as a city is to ensure that every single work site across Boston is safe, and that in particular, the legislation and the ordinances that have been passed in previous years responding to horrific, preventable tragedies are being fully enforced. Those, for example, included a barring of any companies or subcontractors that had significant safety violations on their record from pulling permits in the city. And so all of those pieces we are looking into.
So the portions of the green and orange line are shut down leading into the area while engineers inspect structural safety. You mentioned that you famously take the orange line. How did you get into work today? Is it disrupting your commute?
Today, I commuted in by car. This was part of the calculus, unfortunately. I was on the diverted orange line a couple days, actually earlier that morning on Saturday, coming into downtown with my family to spend a little bit of time enjoying a meal in Chinatown. And already the flow of public transit was being diverted so that the construction demolition project and work could happen. And so at that point, and I think it's continuing now, the Orange Line trains were stopped at Back Bay. Everyone had to get out, wait in line for shuttle buses that would take you anywhere between there and North Station. And so it is quite a complex endeavor that's now happening, not just on the weekends, but also during the week and until we can secure the site and ensure everything is safe.
So are you in contact with MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak? Has he given you a sense of the timing? I mean, I know he had said this morning they weren't even able to get into the tunnels yet to do their inspections. Has he communicated with you at all about the timing of what we might expect on the T front here?
The General Manager has been a great partner. He's been in touch, and I know our teams are talking directly and constantly. I don't have a clear sense of what the timeline will be.
So you talked about this, Mayor Wu. You go into the city on Saturday for dinner with your family. You talked about being at the site. of this horrible tragedy. You know, I've been thinking about what it takes to do what you're doing, be mayor of Boston, be a mom, be a wife, be a daughter. What did you have to leave to go be on that, at that site on Saturday? Did you have to leave dinner? And I just think about, you come back home at the end of the night. What do you do? Do you talk to your kids? Do you read them a story? Do you sit up late in a room and stare at the wall and try to process it?
Yeah. So we had come downtown to Chinatown earlier in the day. We, in fact, had gone to some, you know, another event and had picked up pizza in the South End and were headed home at that point when I saw all of the police cars with sirens flying by and quickly got the alert at that point that something awful had happened. And so at that point, I headed over to the site, family went home and met up with them later. It's, you know, the kids are too young to talk about or even sort of realize sometimes what's happening in the outside world, which I'm relieved at in many situations. But it does take a moment just to kind of shift gears, take a deep breath and try to process a little bit because there's so much happening, and to look at my kids and think about kids now who won't have their dad come home. It's devastating.
Will you have an opportunity to reach out to the Mancini family or speak to officials in Southeastern where he lived? I don't know what the role of a mayor in that kind of situation is.
I have been in contact a little bit with the labor union that Mr. Mancini was part of, and at the appropriate time, we'll definitely do whatever we can. In fact, many Boston residents and members of our team here at City Hall have been wanting to make sure that the entire city passes along our deep, deep condolences and support and love for this family.
We've got some calls and tweets coming in, Mayor Wu, so let's turn to the phones now. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. To ask Boston Mayor Michelle Wu your question, we've got Diana on the line in Boston. Diana, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for my call, taking my call. I have a question regarding rent. My daughter goes to school in Boston and rents from a private place not affiliated with her school. And she just found out that her rent is going up $800 a month next semester. So it'll be $4,600 for a four-bedroom apartment. And how are we expecting these kids to get educated and live with rents going up sky high? We looked at other apartments, and all the people who were leaving their apartments were leaving because their rent went up so high.
Go ahead, Meryl.
Absolutely. This is the issue that our city has to address when it comes to whether people can thrive, afford to stay in Boston, be part of the community here. Everywhere across the city, you hear stories of displacement and residents and families who otherwise love being part of this community just simply unable to stay. And I think as our economy recovers and as many workplaces now move into being hybrid or continued remote opportunities, we really have to step it up to make it possible for families to be here. We are putting the largest chunk of our federal recovery funds towards housing affordability and housing stability, working to create more housing that's affordable, speed up our processes, boost home ownership so people can be fully in control of their housing costs and destinies, and looking to coordinate on the public transportation system so that where there's a larger area where you can live and feel like you can get around conveniently and reliably to where you need to go.
Let's take a tweet on this, on a similar subject. So this tweet is from at @crispo951925263. What does she think of smart Section 8 housing to help tenants succeed, e.g. adding things like Google Nest to the HVAC system?
So all the improvements and funding that we are putting towards, for example, preserving and maintaining the affordable housing at the Mildred Haley development, one of the public housing, subsidized housing developments in greatest need of repairs. All of the funding that is going to creating new affordable housing, this all has to be done from a climate lens around energy efficiency and healthy spaces inside. I think the more that we can ease the burden on residents of our housing to not have to worry about utilities because the insulation is so efficient that you can cut down on your heating and cooling bills, or to even tap into the opportunities for solar panels to help offset your electricity costs. That has to be integrated, and fully want to make sure that across our city, we are looking at ways that smart technology and measuring the results can make a difference. There's an ordinance now that is a huge tool for the city of Boston. It was passed a couple months ago under the leadership of then outgoing Councillor Matt O'Malley, called BIRDO 2.0, around emissions reduction and setting target goals so that all of our buildings, which make up the most, the greatest part of our emissions in Boston, have to over time phase down their emissions. We also just today announced our incoming new chief information officer, who will help lead and drive our technology department to not just deliver digital services and make sure we can accessibly reach everyone with information and programming, but really think about how technology can help improve city services in every way across other departments as well.
Okay, let's ask one more question out of Twitter and then we'll go to a break, Mayor Wu. At Jeff Conley 32, I'm wondering why she doesn't use a more fuel efficient or electric vehicle to get to the T or around the city. It would be a good example for someone promoting a Green New Deal for at City of Boston.
I completely agree. This has been one of my pet peeves since starting the job, as I had imagined coming into office and immediately switching out that vehicle, which is currently a hybrid, for something that is fully electric, for those instances where, for example, a meeting might not be on a public transportation line or needing to get across the city in different directions, et cetera. What I have learned is that the parameters and the procurement processes are very long for something like this. The vehicle is a police vehicle, and so it is secured, and that comes with a number of different features along with the energy efficiency. And so it is in order and on the way, but it's been taking quite a while.
All right. So you're experiencing the same supply chain challenges as everyone else. All right. It is Mondays with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu. What questions do you have for Mayor Wu? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. We also have an email account, radioboston@gmail.com. Mayor Wu, thanks for still being with us. I have to admit, when I ended the week last Friday, I thought the first story we would be talking about today was the North End. I thought that would be the biggest story. Of course, there was the terrible tragedy at the Government Center garage, which we talked about before the break. So now we have the North End restaurant situation, where owners are upset after you announced that restaurant owners in the North End have to pay $7,500 by April 10th in order to participate in outdoor dining this year, and pay several hundred dollars a month for every parking spot they use. There was outcry. Some of the owners have sought legal counsel. You wrote a letter addressing it last Friday, emphasizing that there are more restaurants per capita in the North End than any other neighborhood. So let's start there. Have you received any notice of formal legal action from restaurant owners in the North End at this point?
I have not at this moment, but I can't guarantee that someone else in the city hasn't. So, but I have not heard yet of anything that has happened. And I really believe that the vast majority of community members are on the same page here, both the restaurant owners and the residents, who all just want to see a safe, thriving, healthy, livable community. The North End is unique, and I know that some of the tension here is that certain restaurant owners believe that it's not fair that other restaurant owner, you know, even if this is affordable to them, that restaurant owners in other city, in other parts of the city aren't being charged. And so they feel that they're being targeted, or that the scale of fees to participate in a shortened time frame isn't what they believe that the city should be providing in terms of having an equal treatment across every neighborhood. It is a very different situation in the North End compared to elsewhere, not only in the number of patios, where it's just the scale of 77 public patio locations, or sorry, 79 outdoor dining patios in the North End last year. The next highest neighborhood that wasn't kind of in the downtown area was Back Bay, which had 59, but the North End's sidewalks are very narrow, and so the patios can't fit on the sidewalks. They fit in the street, taking up parking spaces, putting diners close to traffic, and you know, in a neighborhood where there already were no alleys where food drop-off, deliveries, and parking could happen.
So there's there's a lot I want to ask you about in this, Mayor Wu, and you've touched on a piece of it. I'm going to come back to it for just a moment. You've just laid out the arguments for why to do this, the $7,500 here versus another neighborhood. At the same time, do you understand a restaurant owner's argument that another neighborhood doesn't have to pay the $7,500? Or a small restaurant in the North End that maybe can't, the one next to it can. So the next one's going to have, you know, two dozen tables out on the street. And the one who can't afford it is going to be stuck losing all of that business. What about those fairness concerns? I know equity is something you think about a lot.
Absolutely. And in this case, we wanted to make sure that in a part of the city where there is the most intense disruption from outdoor dining, that there could be resources to address this, and that over the course of many months of conversations, and especially with the public meetings that we've had, this was the compromise for outdoor dining in the community. I've had some very, very helpful and positive and productive conversations with the restaurant community as well. And there are some clarifications to the program that we are happy to make. You know, for example, being very clear that this was always intended to be a $1,500 a month monthly fee that added up over the course of 5 months, and that if restaurants want to divide that into monthly installments, that is perfectly possible, rather than making sure that could be upfront.
So it or does not necessarily have to be $7,500 by April 10th?
Right. Or if a restaurant, for example, if for some reason they did not want to start on the first day of outdoor dining, but instead wait a month or two into the program, and they only wanted to have a patio for a few months, that should be charged month by month rather than needing to sort of have the entire time span's fee. There's also a process for hardship waivers. So addressing some of the factors that restaurant owners have lifted up around the difference between if you don't have a liquor license, for example, or you have a smaller street front in front of your store, and so therefore your patio has to be much smaller than others, or if you are not on one of the main streets or Hanover or Salem in the North End, or you're kind of further out in the neighborhood, that might be a different economic situation. So those are all conversations that we're having. The restaurant community is part of the backbone of this neighborhood, and the residents are the other half of it. And so we want to make sure that our communities have a livable neighborhood, safe and clean streets, and that we have the resources to deliver that.
So just to help me clarify, when you wrote the letter last Friday and when there was a restaurant owners meeting last Friday, had you yet communicated some of these possibilities that you're telling me now about flexibility about start, flexibility about when payments come in, consideration for people who are further out or may not have a liquor license, or are these new adjustments in the last, 3 days or so?
We've been having many, many conversations. I think it was important to clarify through, you know, we had received some letters from the restaurant community. So I wanted to make sure to be responsive and be clear that this is a process that we had had, and this is a compromise around what could make this workable in this community. But if people don't feel like it's workable at a critical mass of restaurant owners, then certainly this is something that we do not need to impose on the neighborhood. I believe that the majority of community members on the restaurant owner side and the neighborhood side want to see their local businesses thrive. They want to welcome visitors and tourists in a way that also matches with quality of life there. So I hope that we are headed in the right direction, and we'll be working to continue to hear from our community members on all sides.
Given that we are 2 years into a pandemic and the pain we know restaurants felt, I hear you about why you're doing this. I hear you about the clarity of why you think it's important to do it. Does it bother you at all to do it, given the hits we've known the restaurant industry in particular has taken?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I would not be in this office today if I hadn't gotten frustrated at the restaurant permitting process as an entrepreneur, feeling like government was always trying to slow things down and make it harder when I was just trying to open a tea shop and support my family and do something nice for the community. Wherever possible, we should be supporting our small businesses. I think that the particular situation and the unique impacts of outdoor dining in this very concentrated area of our city has meant that for residents to also have a livable neighborhood, we need to have a different program here than everywhere else.
So last question on this, just because this is from a listener, Will F. from Cambridge, who emailed in asking if you had considered removing private cars and traffic altogether in the North End.
So part of, I should actually communicate also that hundreds of hours of city staff work have gone into really trying to reformulate our outdoor dining program so it can be safe citywide. We were operating under the last 2 years with basically an emergency pilot program and authorization designed to streamline all of the requirements so that we no longer had a case-by-case-by-case application process for outdoor dining patios, but that entire neighborhoods could be kind of granted blanket access if there were certain parameters met. So across the city, we have been making some of those changes. And in the North End in particular, the flow of traffic will be reduced to one way on Hanover Street, coming towards City Hall for that last block where we saw a lot of congestion from delivery trucks and a lot of conflict and potential risk for pedestrians and diners and all of the flow of traffic. And so we're working on those different traffic patterns as well as the resizing of some of the patios to allow for safer pedestrian access, clear guidance around what barriers must be used, especially in the street, again, because there's many neighborhoods where the sidewalks aren't large enough to accommodate the patios right on the sidewalk.
All right, let's go back to the phones here. We'll shift gears. 800-423-8255. Ben is on the line from the South End. Ben, go ahead.
Hi, Mary Lou. Particularly as it gets nicer outside, and particularly in the past couple of years during COVID, it's very common to see neighbors hanging out in a park or walking down the street, enjoying a beer, cocktail, or a glass of wine. No one really seems to be bothered by this. It brings neighbors together, but technically it's still illegal. So my question is, for whom do we maintain these open container laws if no one really seems to be bothered by them? And from an equity perspective, who are the people that benefit from laws that criminalize having a drink in public? And who are the ones who are perhaps disproportionately targeted and penalized by these open container laws?
Yep. So in fact, this question, thank you, Ben, also ties into what we were just talking about, in that one of the main blanket authorizations that the temporary state law allowing for a more streamlined outdoor dining process has given us is also the ability for restaurants to be able to serve alcohol, restaurants with a liquor license, to be able to serve alcohol to customers on public space like sidewalks and in the street. And prior to that, state law prohibited that except through a very cumbersome case-by-case process. And so the state laws here are quite restrictive. And you know, we have seen, I think the most frequent, if you could even call it frequent, cases where this has been actually enforced have been around large-scale events. For example, there was one incident of an arrest at the St. Patrick's Day parade related to this. But by and large, I think, you know, this is a state issue, and we at the city level are working to try to ensure vibrant communities, fun gathering spaces, the chance for people to come back, come together in person. That foot traffic can really help not only build community, but also support and strengthen our small businesses too.
Okay, shifting gears here. Earlier this month, you launched an LGBTQ plus office. Tell us a little bit about the office. Why launch it as its own office, and how are you doing on finding a leader and getting moving on your initial goals?
This was a really beautiful day in City Hall, having the chance to build on work that community members had been advocating for over decades at this point, and to see the transition from the City of Boston's very first LGBTQ liaison staff member who was present, who's currently leading in a different role within the city organization now, as well as the current and, as they described, last or final liaison in this role, because now we're transitioning to a more fully staffed office. I also had the chance to sit with staff and community members involved with the Trans Emergency Fund to hear about the intersectionality between health and housing and safety and civil rights and so many of the areas of need and urgency that are very much present in community today. And so this, similar to how we are reorganizing different parts of city infrastructure, creates a point of focus and accountability, a convening platform to really help bring in resources across all different sectors to center the work that city government can help support and the work that's already happening out in the community.
All right. I want to use our remaining time to talk a little bit about the State Department of Elementary and Secondary Education. They've started a review today of the district's compliance, for lack of a better word, with an MOU that was released in March of 2020 to track progress against some concerns about chronic deficiencies in the district. You know that there are those who have been concerned that this could lead to the state choosing to put the Boston Public Schools in receivership. You've spoken out very clearly that that is not the path that you think would be right. There's been some coverage of this. Here's the first question that's been on my mind about this, Mayor Wu. You are trying to hire a new superintendent of schools for the Boston Public Schools, which means you've got to attract top candidates. I wonder, with the specter that the Boston Public Schools conceivably could be taken into receivership, doesn't that make it incredibly difficult to attract top candidates? And how does that affect your ability to proceed in the short term with a superintendent search?
I am so deeply invested in what happens with our Boston Public Schools. It's the first thing I think about in the morning, as I have to make sure the kids are ready to go and prepared for everything they need to head off to school. And it's a system that I'm quite familiar with, having raised my sister as her legal guardian and on the city council, getting the chance to see and be with our school community members across so many of our schools in the district. This is an exciting place to think about the possibilities for public education. This is an exciting moment for us to really capitalize on the energy to lift up our young people and all the resources the city has. And so I'm confident that the next superintendent will share our great hope and determination that Boston Public Schools will be a leader in what's possible and using every bit of resources available. We welcome those partnerships, including with the state. And so
is there no rock and hard place here, though? I mean, this just, it feels like it throws a spanner in the short terms in the works in terms of finding a new leader. Is there really no rock and hard place here?
I want to be clear that there have been no formal steps towards receivership. And we have made it clear on many levels that the district, myself as mayor, city councilors, do not support that sort of move. The current review and process that the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education is undergoing will be a very helpful process for our city and our district to understand what has changed since the pandemic. The last review was released the same day that our school system shut down within the pandemic 2 years ago. And since then, much has deepened, much has changed. We've also taken some very important steps forward in terms of progress on the issues that were identified. And so this review will help us really get ready and ensure that we have all the information and help set a roadmap for the next leader of the district to come in. And I look forward to challenging every single sector of our city, whether it is in state government or the private sector or nonprofits and anyone who is part of our community, to really get invested in our Boston Public Schools and the incredible treasure of our young people.
All right, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, I appreciate you joining us for Mondays with the Mayor. We will look forward to talking to you in a Monday next month, too. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yesterday, I made dark chocolate avocado pudding, and I tasted it, and it was good. Now, if you eat vegan, maybe that's not so surprising to you. It's not surprising to America's Test Kitchen, either. They have 500 recipes in the complete plant-based cookbook, including the pudding. And it's great timing. We've got warmer weather, picnics, grilling outside, lots of yummy springtime veggies to choose from. So whether you're one of the 10% of adults in the U.S. who now identify as vegetarian or vegan, or maybe you're a meat eater who's vegan curious, they should have something for you today. Join the conversation. Do you have burning questions about what meatless substitutions, for example, that you can make? Or maybe to do what to do with a pesky veggie that keeps showing up on sale and you want to buy it at the grocery store, but you don't know how to cook it, or you've got a CSA and it keeps showing up in your box. Maybe there's some other plant-based ingredient that you're curious to cook with, but you don't know how. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet us at Radio Boston. So here in Studio 3, Julia Collin Davison, who is an executive editorial director for America's Test Kitchen. She's also co-host of America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Country and host of Julia at Home. Julia, welcome to the studio.
Yes, thank you. Nice to see you in person.
Great to have you here in person. We also do have on the line Dan Zuccarello, who is the executive food editor for Cookbooks at America's Test Kitchen. Dan, welcome. I'm assuming that means that you know pretty much every recipe we might talk about today.
I hope so. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so glad to have you both. I want to start with this cookbook that I'm talking about. I'm holding it here. It's rather large and heavy, full of recipes. It's called The Complete Plant-Based Cookbook, 500 Inspired Flexible Recipes for Eating Well Without Meat. So, Julia, when I picked it up, I thought, okay, is this option or mission? And what I mean was, did you set out to give people plant-based options, or is this book set out to convince people to eat plant-based diets?
I'd say both. But I think it's more option than mission. I think a lot of people are curious about plant-based diets. You hear about it a lot. It's a health, you know, think of being healthy. It's also, a lot of people think it's kinder to the environment because there's a huge environmental impact with lots of animal products. And I think most people, you get, especially when you get to a certain age, you realize you need more vegetables in your diet. I like to think all of us are part-time vegans, right? Just, we all have meals that don't have meat in them. And what kind of struck me, what I love about this book is I'm a big meat eater. I'll just put that out there. And when I thought, oh, we're going to take the meat off the plate, I thought we were going to have to throw everything but the kitchen sink at these recipes to make them taste like something. And the reverse was true. When you started stripping out things and just started tasting the vegetables and you really could pick out individual flavors and put those flavors together, it was magical. It was kind of, for me, it was an eye-opener. Like eating plant-based food is actually more flavorful a lot of the time because the flavors shine through.
So Dan, to that point, and I'm a meatosaurus myself, so maybe you know, revealing a little bias here, but one of the questions that we had was, okay, so what's the sneaky recipe in this cookbook, Dan? The one that if you want to really get people on board with eating plant-based, They're like, oh, I love this. I had no idea. What's the sneaky one, the best sneaky one?
Well, I will tell you, I mean, in my house, you know, you can't make a bad taco for dinner. And so I think for me, there's a really great Baja taco that we worked on, kind of takes inspiration from like classic Baja taco. Think about fish taco. It's got this really delicious crispy coating. We have some fun with it. We obviously don't use fish. We use cauliflower as the filling for the taco, but it's got this really delicious coconut crust that just plays really well with that nuttiness of the cauliflower, really crunchy, bright cabbage and mango topping. Just a lot of really interesting flavors coming together. Everyone is familiar with a taco. They probably have, you know, a taco night. This is a great, easy option. Definitely could win over the family.
So let me put the phone number out, 1-800-423-8255. So maybe you've got questions out there about how to make a taco that tastes great for your family, doesn't have any meat in it, or other meat substitutes that you can use from a more plant-based diet. Give us a call and ask your questions. So I noticed that, you know, the note of mango there, Jill, the note of coconut. And I do wonder, are there certain seasonings or spices that are kind of magic as you're moving from a more meat-oriented diet to a plant-based diet to really wake things up?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, they have a popular name now, umami. It's that other taste that you can sense besides just sweet, salty, tart, and bitter. So umami is that meaty flavor. And there's a lot of umami in some vegetable-based flavorings. Think about all your tomato products, tomato paste, especially mushrooms, anything that's soy-based, soy sauce, Parmesan cheese, although that's not vegan. But there's actually nutritional yeast, which is part of our vegan Parmesan. We used it so often, we started calling it nooch. Put a little nooch in there.
Nooch.
Yeah. So if you're going to put some of these things in your pantry, definitely go for the nooch, because you can just sprinkle it. If you've never had nooch on popcorn, you're missing out. It is better, as good as butter.
Wow.
In my world, it's better than butter.
And is it easy to get? Are
yeah.
these products that, I mean, I always, when we do a cooking segment, I'm always a little concerned about price,
yeah.
that when you get rarefied items, it can be less affordable.
Yeah, it's true. But you're not paying for meat. And meat is some of the most expensive stuff in the supermarket these days. And like nutritional yeast, it's been in the stores, on the shelves. You've been reaching around it for years to grab another product. It's there.
It's there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Dan, what about some other go-to ingredients? If one wants to, so we're going with option, not mission here,
option.
Right? So, Dan, if one wants to begin to build a kitchen that is affordable and ready for more plant-based recipes, what are some of the other key ingredients that maybe you pick up a few at a time while you're at the grocery store and start stocking your cupboard, your refrigerator, your freezer with these things?
Well, I'm thinking, you know, you're speaking to cost effectiveness. I like to buy in bulk. I think grains and beans are a great opportunity to buy in bulk. I think you find a lot of grocery stores these days, they have that bulk section where you can buy, you know, as much or as little as you want. I like to have some fun with the grains. I mean, really, you have a pot of water on the stovetop. You can throw most grains in a pot of water with some salt. And as long as you keep an eye on it, you can be assured that you'll get a pretty good tender result. And so it's pretty straightforward in terms of cooking. It's a great pantry ingredient to kind of keep on hand. And
I'm sorry, Dan, I'm just going to interrupt you for a second. So give me a couple examples of grains.
Oh, I mean, bulgur is a great one. I use that all the time. Faro, Italian whole grain, which is really great. Could be even something simpler like brown rice. Maybe you kind of regularly go for white rice and you try a little bit more of a whole grain brown rice. It's really great.
All right. So I want to talk about a couple of recipes. Jill, your favorite plant-based recipe that just kind of delights you, your palate, what you love to eat?
Oh, it's got to be the cauliflower buffalo bites. So it's a riff on buffalo wings, but and it's actually very reminiscent of a traditional dish that you find over in India. But it's a spicy cauliflower. They're rolled in coconut milk instead of egg, and then they're fried and tossed in the sauce. I mean, it is just the recipe is supposed to serve four people. It barely serves me and my husband at home because it's just too good. And everybody likes them. Like I haven't met a person who hasn't thought, man, those are worth making.
All right. So let's talk about how polite you are for a minute, because apparently I have accidentally called you Jill instead of Julia twice since this segment started. I'm sorry, Julia. I don't usually make mistakes like that. So thank you for being very patient with me. As somebody who's got a difficult name to pronounce, I'm usually pretty much a stickler about that. All right, so Dan, how about you? The one that just delights you, your palate, what you love to eat the most.
Well, I mean, I talked about tacos. I think my second favorite, maybe this is my first favorite, is a great pasta dish. And this is another one where, you know, someone who's trying to get into plant-based cooking, this is an easy, you know, door into that new, you know, way of cooking, because pastas, you can throw a lot of different great things into pasta and make a dinner with that, you know.
Yes, let's talk pastas.
Fresh greens, you know, fresh vegetables. Like you're saying, we're in the spring season, a lot of really delicate vegetables that do well with pastas.
All right, so I want to talk for a minute now about this, and I'm picking mine up, and I have, Julia has a bowl with a spoon, too.
I'm excited to try the food you made for me.
Yeah, so, and Marquise, our sound technician, has a spoonful in there that he's going to eat with us while we all try this. So here's the deal, right? This is a dark chocolate pudding where avocado essentially is used to form the substance, the texture of the pudding. Now, I'm going to tell you, I picked it in part because we are New England, and we have this former quarterback of the New England Patriots, Tom Brady, who seems to be having found the fountain of youth, and he eats avocado everything. So I was curious, can you actually make almost anything with avocado? And Julie, I'm going to let you taste it first. Tell me how I did.
Perfection.
Did I do all right?
You nailed it. Excellent. This is amazing.
Yay, thank you.
Yes.
So I'm going to take a taste too here.
It's good.
Now, I have to say, pudding is my happy place.
Is it?
Yes. It takes me all the way back to childhood. I came from a very large family, youngest of 8 living kids, 9 kids. Desserts can be expensive. Pudding was something you could actually get enough of. Like, so pudding is my happy place. Why do I love this when it's got avocado in it?
Yeah. Well, for a lot of people, eggs and dairy, you know, if you're trying to stay away from it or you have reactions to it, and it also makes it really heavy. When you swap out the eggs and the dairy for an avocado, all of a sudden the chocolate flavor shines
so
through.
So chocolatey.
Yeah. It's super chocolatey because it's not weighed down with all that dairy in terms of flavor. And for many people, right, if you stay away from the dairy, it's a bit healthier for some people. And, you know, it's interesting. If you make pudding a lot, and it sounds like you do, this is kind of a fun variation that just changes it up a bit.
So, Dan, I have a couple questions, though, about as I was using the recipe, right? So, one, it relies heavily on a food processor because it really whips the avocado so you don't get any grainy avocado texture. I don't own a food processor, so I used a blender, which was an ungodly mess, but it did work. Can you, in general, use a blender instead of a food processor for this kind of cooking?
Well, I'm impressed. That was an interesting spin on it. But I'm glad to hear that you were successful using the blender. I think if someone doesn't have a food processor, I think that they could certainly mash it pretty well in a bowl. And then if they've got a fine mesh strainer, you can do this technique where you could put it into the fine mesh strainer and kind of push it through the fine mesh strainer. It really, the key here is you want this to be as creamy and smooth as possible, right? And the food processor does that. But I think pushing it through a fine mesh strainer, you know, worst case scenario, it might be a little bit more rustic, but it would still be just as delicious.
All right. So the other technique question I had, Julia, when I made this, so you use cocoa powder. I didn't put the espresso powder in. I didn't want any coffee flavor. I'm a chocolate purist. I don't want anything interfering with the chocolate flavor. But so, folks, you know, this one's got unsweetened cocoa powder, sugar, vanilla, water, a little bit of salt. But you then melt bittersweet chocolate, and it gets added at the end.
Mm-hmm.
I make like homemade chocolate cream pie. I'm used to melting unsweetened chocolate. It melts very well in the microwave. This didn't.
Yeah.
Did I do something wrong? Is bittersweet chocolate different?
Oh, then unsweetened chocolate? Oh, definitely. Chocolate has only a few ingredients in it. It's the cocoa solids, the cocoa butter. And so those two things make up unsweetened chocolate. When you add in sugar, it throws everything. Chemically, it's a very different process. And so when you melt it, yeah. Now, I'm curious. Did you use 50% power?
I did.
You did? And did you go in and whisk it every once in a while?
I did. And what happened was at first it looked like it was working, and then it was like it balled up again.
Oh, it got too hot.
Is that what it was?
Yeah, or okay. A little water got in there and it seized. Okay. But you were able to use it anyway.
And yeah, just a good elbow grease and a whisk.
And yeah, and you put it back together.
That's right.
Yeah, I think, if I have this right, I think chocolate, when you melt it and it solidifies again, it can go into, Dan, correct me if I'm wrong, 7 different crystallized...
Holy cow.
Solutions, and only one of them is the one where it retains nice and glossy. That's called tempering. So when you temper chocolate, you're looking for that one. Am I right, Dan? Is it 7 or is it 5?
Oh, I'm going to go with you and say 7. That sounds an impressive number. I'm going to go 7.
Yeah. And also, how old was your chocolate? Was it fresh?
Brand new. We just bought it.
Oh, yeah. And what brand was it?
It was Godiva.
Oh.
60% whatever, bittersweet.
Godiva. And 60% is on the low side, so okay. That's a pretty sweet chocolate. I've never worked with Godiva baking chocolate. I always use our winner in the test kitchen,
which is
something else.
All right, so listen, we've got a little bit of time left. For a person, Dan, who is looking to start maybe that first recipe that they can go to that is maybe their first plant-based recipe they've tried, a really simple one that you would recommend.
Well, so you were talking about we're coming into the spring season. I think this is actually the great, a great season to start because, like you said, the farmers markets, the bounty is there. You've got a lot of really great vegetables to work with. And the great thing is you don't need to do much to them. It's warmer out. Everyone's starting to do some grilling. For me, grilling is a great way to cook in general, but especially with vegetables because it adds so much flavor and it's not that hard to do. So, some fresh zucchini, you've got asparagus that's coming up right now. All these vegetables that you could just simply grill, season salt and pepper, a little bit of lemon juice. And like I said, you pair that with a whole grain, like we talked about, maybe a bean, you've got yourself quite a meal.
All right. And Julia, we've got maybe 60 seconds left or so for you. That vegetable that has surprised you the most, sort of the sneak attack where you're like, oh, I love this.
Radishes.
Really?
Radishes sandwich, radish pickles where you soak them in vinegar and a little salt. It takes the sharpness out of them and you can just crunch on them nonstop, adding them to salads, putting them in soups or stews. You can roast them and they turn sweet. And you put it with a little dressing made with tahini. It's out of this world.
You can roast a radish.
And they're amazing. You can saute them. They almost take on a super sweet potato-y texture. It's out of this world. It changes its flavor dramatically. And they're always around. You'll always find them at the market.
Fantastic. Okay. So lots of great advice there if you either are living a plant-based life and want some new recipes or maybe you want to try one of these recipes for the first time. That was Julia Collin-Davison, an executive editorial director for America's Test Kitchen. She's the co-host of America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Country. Julia, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for the pudding.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Also, Dan Zuccarello, executive food editor for cookbooks at America's Test Kitchen. Dan, thanks for joining us on the line. Great to talk to you, too.
It was a pleasure.
All right, folks, Julia and I are going to finish our pudding in here. That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Thanks for joining us. How about you join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston?